Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mierler here. Is your car ready for your summer road trip? Jim Ward back with us today to help you with that. He's the service manager at Smart Motors, over 10 years of master certification, and he joins us every other month to help you out with your vehicle questions. So, what questions do you have about getting your vehicle ready for vacation or summer in general? Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Again, love to hear from you, so give a call or shoot us an email. And Jim Ward, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be back.
Well, I would think one of the first things to check before going on a road trip this summer would be the air conditioning.
Well, certainly is. And, you know, I know when I was younger, the main thing was my playlist. But, you know, yeah. there comes a point where more important things come up. And, you know, the current conditions, this is the last kind of situation that you want to have a breakdown, you know, and have to have help or be sitting beside the road. So really, you know, one way I look at this is the things that we see people on their road trips broken down because of. And one of the most common is a battery. And there are, you know, there's a test that can be done on your battery to predict its future potential. Typically, that's done with a multi-point inspection. Just about any shop you're going to take your car to for regular services, even if you just go in for an oil change or a tire rotation, are going to recommend and probably just complimentary do this multi-point inspection. And part of that is that they're going to check the battery, they're going to look over all the fluids, check the tires, check the brakes. So that kind of a multi-point inspection is the ideal thing to have done before a trip. So, you know, but the kind of things we see sometimes are not even what you'd think of. I mean, one of the more common scenarios, at least a couple of times a year, we have someone come in that was on a canoe trip and lost all their keys.
Oh.
Tip over or something. So if you're going to be doing something like that and taking your keys along, have a fail-safe plan someplace, you know, put them on your person or float. You know, that is just one of those frustrating things that kind of ends the trip. You know, we also see things that we don't necessarily see it here, but one of the things I'll tell you is that different people end up driving the cars. I know in my own experience, we've taken my wife's car on the trip, and I'm not used to driving that car, watching the gas gauge. It's got a very different range in mind, came close to running out of gas a couple of times. So, you know, there are some things beyond the breakdowns of the car, but certainly that multi-point inspection, checking all of the basic fluids, the battery, the brakes, the tires are the critical things.
Air conditioning, any kind of a problem typically? What do they look for? Just the fluids?
Well, they test it. You know, the air conditioner is pretty simple with an operational test to turn it on and see if it feels cold, and run it for a while. But honestly, if you don't tend to use air conditioner a lot and then suddenly start using it, some of the surprise things can come up, even if the air conditioner is cooling and working fine, is that the air conditioner takes moisture out of the air, and that moisture can really accumulate. You'd be amazed. You can look at a car on a hot, humid day and just idling at an intersection, and you'll see water streaming out of a hose under the car, which is perfectly normal. That is all of the moisture it took out of the air. But those systems can get plugged up. So if you don't run your air conditioner a lot, but you turn it on occasionally, no cools before that trip, turn it on, use it for a good half hour one day, and make sure that water's all draining out. Because if that drain gets plugged, all of a sudden you've got water splashing on your foot, and that, of course, then the air conditioner unit in the dash is half underwater. It's not going to cool as well. So odd things like that, you know, the system itself may be working fine, but that drain can get plugged. And if you just use it 10 minutes on the way to work, you may not realize it. Run it for 20 to 30 minutes one day and make sure that all the water, you see it draining out to the bottom. And on a hot, humid day, you'll just see a steady stream coming out.
I can think about some of my camping trips where I had that car so loaded with cargo. You know, you begin to wonder, is this a problem for the car?
Sure.
All that extra weight.
Yep. And you know, you can do the math on the driver's door jamb or on the door itself. There's a placard. It's a little card. It might be about the size of a credit card. Could be a little longer than that, more rectangular. And it's got some various ratings on it. One of them is a GCWR, the gross combined weight rating. And that is going to be the maximum permissible combined weight of the, if you have a tow vehicle, trailer, everything you load in your vehicle, this is presuming your fluids are full and everything. And that number is the the one that you can't exceed. So there's another number, the gross vehicle weight rating, which is the capacity of the unloaded vehicle. The difference in those things is what you can take. So the only other factor that comes into this is that particularly with smaller vehicles and hybrids in particular, weight may not be the only consideration, because if you put a car top carrier on, you're creating extra drag coefficient, and that can affect particularly smaller vehicles, more economy and hybrid vehicles. If you get close to the weight but are also carrying part of it in a car top carrier, you could be kind of maxing out that load a bit more than just the weight itself would, because of the drag of the wind on that.
And, I haven't mentioned tires, but and we talk about tires and, when you ought to consider replacing and that sort of thing. And I know you've got a system for doing that, sort of a anybody, if they've got a penny, I think, in their pocket.
Right, you can measure that with a penny, but there are some things to consider too. If one of the things is that the legal wear limit is 2/32nds, you never really want to get down there. At 3 and 4, 4 and 5/32nds of an inch of tread, the tread's pretty good, be good for normal driving. But if you get in heavy water conditions where it's raining very hard, those tires are more likely to hydroplane, and they also give you considerably increased stopping distance. So that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to replace them, but you know if you're driving in wet conditions, you know that your tires are in the range of 5/32nds, and you want to try to get the rest of the mileage out of them, you need to leave yourself more stopping distance in that wet condition to make sure that if there's an emergency stop on the road ahead of you, that you've left enough space that you're able to stop. Because if the guy in front of you is doing an emergency stop and he's got brand new tires and you're doing the same emergency stop and you've got 5/32nds, your car's going to stop about 10 car lengths later than his, and that is going to be an impact.
Do tires ever blow out anymore? Do you ever get blowouts?
We do. The primary causes of a tire blowing out are that typically that it's underinflated or overinflated are the most common things that will cause it. Road hazard damage, something, debris in the road or even great big potholes can do it. Worn tires, if your tires get worn enough, and then just installation errors. Defects can occur, but we see fewer and fewer tire defects. A tire that blows out is almost always the result of a road hazard. And one of the more common road hazards out there are actually bits of other tires, semi-tires. You see this all the time. You're driving down the road and you see a semi-tire recap came apart and you see bits of it on the road, and that's got some wire in it that if you run it over can actually take your tire out. So it's something to be pretty careful of, watching ahead on the road and try to avoid, to change lanes if you can. Obviously you want to be safe and be looking ahead just like any traffic situation, but that is probably about the most common road hazard people hit.
Let's take some calls. Suzanne in Vesper will go to you first. Suzanne, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my question. I want to know, my question is not related to a road trip. I would like to know whether or not for an underframe, it's coming from down. I have a little, excuse me. I have a little Chevrolet Cavalier, a 2005, and I want to know if I can, or what it should cost me to get an underframe for that car.
I'm not sure what we're even talking about there, but something like a Cavalier, there are vehicles like pickup trucks that have ladder frames that are not like an integral part of the body and chassis of the car. Chevy Cavalier is more of a unibody. And so, is the concern here, Suzanne, is it rust that you've got on the bottom of the car?
I haven't driven it for 2 years. I don't really know. That's a stop right now, and he says it would cost me about $1,500. Coming from down south, and so that means it's not a new one.
Okay, and that is certainly a viable thing to do. It sounds like you may be needing a specific component rather than like the whole vehicle frame. Rather vague terms are used. I'm at the price that you're suggesting, I'm thinking they're probably talking about what we'd call an engine cradle. There's a big square kind of rectangular framework that bolts up that holds the engine and transmission in. I'm not sure that's it, but ultimately, this is certainly not the kind of you know, not a common job that you, you know, most shops will have common prices. You call in and in 30 seconds they can tell you what a tune-up runs or this or, you know, brake job or that. But I'm not sure specifically what repair we're really talking about on that car by calling an underframe. But, you know, I would call a couple of Chevy dealers and just inquire there. They specialize in that and try to get some more specifics on who's recommending this on exactly what component this is.
Yeah.
Because an underframe is a pretty vague term that it could be parts of various suspension or certain components, but I think we're talking about the engine cradle. But yeah, more specifics would need to be known, and the best source for that information, that pricing information, are going to be Chevy dealers, or you know, depending on what it actually is, it may even be a body shop. But again, I need more information.
All right, there you go, Suzanne. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. Give a call, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Herb in Mauston next. Hi, Herb.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a two-car family, and I've tried to change spark plugs in one of them a while back, and then I had a headlight go out on another one, and the headlight took me only 2 hours to replace. I had to take the wheel well out before I could get to the headlight, and the spark plugs I gave up on and took it to a mechanic. So we're going to be needing to replace these cars soon. Do you have any recommendations for either brands and or types, you know, like a car or a pickup versus something else that would make it easier to work on the simple maintenance things that you need to do on a car?
Well, what kind of cars are the two that you have?
Well, one's the Mazda and one's the Subaru.
Okay.
We always try to go for efficiency when it comes to cars as far as mileage goes and whatnot.
Sure. You know, a lot of the design factors that have gone into cars in the last 10 to 20 years have not had much to do with how easy they are to work on. They've had a lot to do with crash safety and crumple zones and a lot of issues that do make working in the cars more difficult. So it's hard to tell you what. You know, maybe a better way to look at this, the way I would frame this, are what cars have the fewest issues that you're going to be least likely to have to work on at all to begin with, you know, and then when you do need to either work on the car yourself or have it worked on, what is the market in your area familiar with? So, you know, if it sounds like you like to try to do things yourself, but if there's a shop that you're familiar with, you know, and you trust, I would probably ask them that question, because if you find that you're going to go into it and try to do it, but, you know, you may or may not be able to. If you can't and you're going to go to that shop, then you certainly want it to be something they're familiar with, comfortable working on. You know. Obviously, I work at a Toyota dealership. I think they're great products, but I look at them now compared to 30, 40 years ago. And back then, we were sometimes amazed at how the engineers, oh, look what they did here so that we could make this job easier to do. And less and less, that's the case. I mean, again, so much safety consideration that it just is not easy to work on some things. Like you say, a headlight, you just think this should just take a couple of minutes. And literally, yes, 1 to 2 hours sometimes, and sometimes it's just a little experience. Things like spark plugs, you know, I'm not sure what you ran into on the spark plugs, but one of the counterintuitive things about spark plugs is you don't want to do them on a cold engine. You want to do them on a hot engine. It makes them easier to come out. It does not make them easier to handle once you take them out, you know, and the engine's hot, and it's not fun leaning over trying to do it with the engine hot, but it makes all the difference in the world that a hot plug will screw right out, whereas a cold plug will feel like it's seized in there and you can't get it. So, you know, sometimes the difficulty of the job is just based on the experience and knowing just the right condition to do it.
There you go. Or get yourself a, what, 57 Chevy or something.
Well, or you know, there's some great manuals too. Some repair manuals, the factory manuals are often difficult to follow, and they make car repair for dummies is just one of the examples that they call it, which I, you know, Haynes manuals, there's a various different brands of manuals that often have better instructions and will give you some of that background and say, hey, this is easier to do if you have this engine hot, you know, as opposed to a cold engine. But yep, that can also be very helpful.
Yeah,
Herb, thanks again.
Real good luck using YouTube to find some shortcuts.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Herb. Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Thanks, Herb.
Mark in Sparta, it's your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I've got a couple questions. First of all, we got a 2000 2013 Lexus. Of course, my wife didn't drive it for a month and a half because of the COVID thing. And I had to jump start it, and all the codes and errors went goofy on it. The air conditioner didn't work for a while until we got back into the book and read how to reset the dash program and all that. Mm-hmm. And I got an F-150 Ford, and I'm comparing it to my 2006 Toyota. When I change the oil in the two different vehicles, the Toyota oil is clean as a whistle, and the Ford is just black. Why would that be? And I'll hang up and listen to you. Thank you.
Well, they're not everything necessarily is equal. So the 06 Toyota and the F-150 maybe have very different mileage on them. So if the F-150 has 250,000 and the Toyota has 80,000, that's going to be one reason that you're getting more through. But also how we use a vehicle. Oil gets dirty when the engine that it's in gets loaded. So, you know, if you are using that F-150 to tow things it's a little bit less efficient engine to start with because it's made to handle more weight and tow things around. So even if you aren't towing things around, that engine is going to dirty oil a little faster, and the degree to which you do use it as a truck and tow things and load it up is going to increase that as well. And if the F-150 is four-wheel drive and you're using four-wheel drive in the wintertime, that's load just like carrying or towing something. So, beyond just older vehicle versus new vehicle, how they're designed, what they're made to, and how you use it are big factors in how quickly the oil gets dirty. And, you know, interestingly, the question you brought up with the Lexus, when a vehicle like that sits for a long time, modern vehicles are managed by many computers. That Lexus probably has 24 computers on it. And so those computers have set parameters for learned values on how to operate things. And when the battery goes dead, you may jumpstart it and get it running again, but it may take 20 to 30 minutes sometimes for all those computers to acknowledge one another. And sometimes you have to manually do things you may find, for example, that your power windows don't work automatically anymore. Most vehicles, you'd have to, there's a quick little trick of running it all the way up and holding that switch a couple of seconds after it's gone all the way up, run it back. This is just the driver's window because it's that's all. And running it back down and holding that switch up, in the down position a couple of seconds after it's gone down. And that simple process where we reinitialize those power windows so the automatic function and the jam protection that stops the window when it feels something in it work again. So there are many systems, electrical systems on the car have those kind of things that may be lost if the battery's gone dead from a car sitting for a long time, like many of us have experienced lately.
Thanks very much for that question. Appreciate it. Jim Ward, our guest today, service manager at Smart Motors. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at vehicle maintenance today and summer road trips with our guest, Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Question, give a call, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take another call. Judy in Mount Sterling, it's your turn. Hi, Judy. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for the program. I have a 92 Buick Park Avenue with about 80,000 miles on it, sitting in my garage, hasn't been started or driven in 15 years. I'm considering giving it over to a mechanic and give him an opportunity to get it going again. Can you tell me, give me a priority list of what absolutely needs to be done so I don't get any unnecessary reboots?
Mm-hmm.
What so do we have to do?
For 15 years, that's a very popular subject that people just love filming those and producing YouTube videos on, that this is the story, has to be a barn find kind of things. Well, basically where we usually start is pulling the spark plugs out and then having someone take a wrench and trying to mechanically turn the engine over and see if it will turn over. If it will, that's good news. And you want to put some oil into those cylinders and try to work that manually and try to get some lubrication where there hasn't been any for 15 years. Because, if you were to try to just have a battery charge and try to start it, you could do some damage if it did start. So there's certainly some preventative things that need to be done. And again, that starts with pulling the spark plugs out, trying to turn it over manually. If you can't turn it over manually, then you need to put oil in there, and you may want to put you know, something like automatic transmission fluid in it that is a detergent oil that might help clean it up, and then let that soak in there, you know, maybe 4 ounces in each cylinder, let it soak in there overnight, and then try turning it by hand again. You know, this is a process that really needs to be undertaken by an experienced technician who knows what they're doing, because there are so many things. That's where you start, but beyond that, whether you have spark or not, you know, for the ignition system, so many things could happen to a vehicle sitting 15 years, even though it's garage, you know, better than sitting out in a field, but mice can get in there and, you know, and basically damage the electrical system. So somebody who really is experienced at that kind of project is who needs to do this. Sounds like you may have someone in mind, but what they may need to do and the steps they need to do could be very unique from one car to the other.
There you go, Judy. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Lisa in Madison next. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, I am buying a used exterior 2012 Ford Escape door, and it's just the skin. I'm just wondering how long it takes to put the molding back on the electric on that.
I didn't catch everything, Lisa. Would you repeat that?
Yeah, please.
It's a 2012 Ford Escape door I'm buying used, just the skin, and I'm wondering how long it takes to put the molding back on and the electric. It's the rear passenger door.
So usually when we say a door skin, we're talking about just the outer sheet metal. But it sounds like you're buying a whole used door, right?
Yep, without the molding.
Without the molding. So the molding, if you're experienced, the molding is a pretty quick job. I mean, there's different ways that moldings are held on cars. Sometimes they've got clips. It could, you know, where there's little holes in the door skin and the molding has clips that go through. Most often, though, they're just self-adhesive, and it's a matter of just getting it aligned well and make sure you're putting it on a clean surface. Use some isopropyl alcohol or something and clean it and dry it before you put it on. But then you mentioned the electrical, and specifically, are you just talking about the electric components in the door?
Yes, for the power window.
You'll have a wire harness that comes out the leading edge of the door and a connector where that connects to the rest of the vehicle's wire harness. And typically, it's just a disconnect and reconnect. Power window, power mirrors, power locks, all that go through that wire harness. And it typically is just one big bulk connector that is going to connect. Sometimes they've got more than one connector, but mostly, and a 12 Ford Escape, I think it's just a single connector that connects all those things to a body connection at the front of the door. You may have to take a grommet off the body panel in front of the door. Wire may go through that. The connector may be on the other side, but that also. These are pretty simple things. Hanging the door on, getting it aligned, getting the hinges right and everything are far more difficult. Those are a couple of the easiest things, getting the molding on and getting the electrical reconnected.
All right, Lisa, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Tim says he has a 2008 Mercedes GL450. The power steering pump is leaking fluid, and it growls and is hard to turn the steering wheel. Is it a big project to change the power steering pump?
That is kind of a bigger project. I mean, this is a belt driven pump on an 08 Mercedes Benz, and basically the other thing that you're going to do, and this is the easier probably than replacing the pump, but the growling that you're hearing is a bearing that's failing in that pump, and so when you have a power steering fluid leak, until you do the replacement, keeping the fluid level up, as the fluid level drops, you hear more and more grinding, and it's doing more and more damage. So, you know, watching it and not letting it get low and not getting to the point where you hear that sound is the key here to preventing damage to other components. Because what's happening is that little metal filings are coming out of that pump, and they're getting in the fluid, and they're going through the system, and they're going through the steering rack, which has got little seals, and other things can be damaged. So the pump is not an easy do-it-yourself job. Again, this is something you've got access to the internet. I suggest Googling it. People will have videos showing it, and you can judge for yourself whether that's within your wheelhouse and skill levels or not. But the other thing I'm going to recommend is that you consider flushing all the fluid out of that, because that fluid's going to have metal in it. That's not going to be good for your new pump that you put on. It's not good for the steering rack that's on there. So beyond getting that worn pump out of there, you want to get all the little metal fragments that it's been releasing into the fluid and the rest of the system flushed out once you get that new pump on.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, let's take another call. Kyle in Prairie du Chien, it's your turn. Hi, Kyle. Kyle, we're not hearing you.
Yes. Okay, I've got a question about a formula that I heard a few years ago as to whether or not to repair a vehicle depending on the cost of the repair and the value of the vehicle.
Okay. Well,
so your question, Kyle, is?
Well, it certainly makes sense to take a look at what the cost of repairs and the value of the vehicle, although there's some gray area here. Where the one question is, you know, where are you getting the figure for the value of your vehicle? Because you can use many sources out there, Kelley Blue Book, Edmunds, Carfax, but they're not always what you're going to get in the market for a given vehicle. Some vehicles hold their value better, and those numbers can often be off by a couple thousand dollars. And, you know, there are times where it just, you also have to look at what is the cost to change vehicles, what is the cost to get out of this vehicle and get into something else. But it is certainly something that you want to consider. It is, you know, there does come a time where you put enough into a vehicle, it gets a certain age and mileage where it just doesn't make sense anymore, and it's time to think about something else. But I wish I could tell you that there was a simple formula for that, but to my knowledge, it isn't. It's more like every situation is individual with that individual person's finances, what they could really afford to do if they can't fix this car. And again, finding what the real value of the car is a little more complicated than just, you know, throwing it on one of those websites and seeing what they say, because you also need to look at the market and see what people are asking for and actually paying for them and getting for them, because that can be a difference, a significant difference. Sometimes on an older used car, it could be, you know, a third of the value of the car or more that is different from what the market guides say.
Yeah, you know, and sometimes I can remember my own circumstances, a car that I just had to, you know, it seemed like it was nickel and diming me to death, and I got so sick of it, I just, one day when I got the next estimate for what needed to be, what it was going to cost to fix it, I said, the heck with this. I drove. In fact, I drove the Smart Motors, as a matter of fact, and bought a new car.
And you know, it, sometimes that makes sense, and sometimes it's a matter of budgeting. I mean, often when we have a problem with the car, and it, you know, in my best world, our shop and all shops are consultative, and they'll tell you choices and tell you different things. And so, but sometimes what you get is it's failed. That's it. This is what it costs to replace it. And some, there may be alternatives. You know, how likely is this to cause a breakdown? How long could I possibly manage it? Like, you know, power steering fluid leak, you could manage that leak for quite a while by adding fluid. Of course, that fluid's running out, and there's an environmental concern about where that oil is going. But you know, if your budget's not going to afford it right now, then the best advice you can get is consultative advice to tell you how to manage it, not just to say it's failed, it's got to be replaced, period.
Let's go to Kenneth in Janesville now. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. I'm wondering if I've got a real complicated problem or what. It all started with not being able to take the key in or out of the ignition switch. But now the car turns on, and the ignition repair person says that it is not an ignition problem. But the AC fan doesn't turn on, and the windows don't open, and the airbags don't blow up, and some other
things. So what
kind
of a car have you got, Kenneth?
Oh, it's a 2002 Dodge Stratus.
And so you were having a problem for a while that you had difficulty getting the key in the ignition and getting it back out?
Right. I mean, that's okay. Where I couldn't get the key in, and then I couldn't get it out. And the ignition person says it's not an ignition problem. It's in the switches that are, part of the key.
Sure. Yep. Your key, of course, is mechanical, and it's called a lock cylinder or a key cylinder that you put it in for the ignition or for a door. It's a door lock cylinder, and that's all mechanical. And sometimes a key not sticking can be related to that, but often there's also interlock systems that won't let the key come out unless you put it in park, to make sure that you put it in park, for example. And that is separate from that ignition cylinder. The person you're talking to is correct. There are switches on the back side of that. that also have to be engaged and obviously turn those systems on for those systems to work properly. I can't say it's a foregone conclusion that the problem is those switches. Perhaps that person's done diagnostic work and confirmed that those switches have all the inputs and that's where the problem is, but it could be in other areas of electronics that, you know, control units and other connections and wire harnesses and stuff too that can cause those kind of problems. So that's not typically a simple do-it-yourself kind of get to the bottom of this and fix it. It sounds like you're working with somebody that is looking at it, but yep, someone needs to do some electronic diagnosis and find out why the switches aren't operating in a way to both let you remove the key and put it in properly and to operate those electrical components.
Yeah, there we go, Kenneth. Thank you for calling. Nancy in Middleton, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. About a year ago, I purchased a 2019 GMC Acadia. Love it. Bought it on the internet, but it only came with one key fob. And I was just wondering, if I lose that key fob, I'm out of luck. Do I have to go through the dealer to get a replacement, or is there something I can just do on the internet to get another one, or a locksmith to get another key fob?
Sure. It typically is going to come down to a locksmith or a dealership, and locksmiths have not been in this business a long time. The one of the complications is that vehicle's key is programmed to a computer in the car. And so, you know, if you buy a used vehicle and you get one of those key fobs, there is one that is a master and the rest of them are valet. And a new one can only be made from the master typically. So if you get a valet one, it doesn't allow all the functions that a master key does, like getting in a trunk or getting in a storage area, necessarily getting in the glove box. So a dealership certainly could do it, but when you check out locksmiths, often you can get a better deal at a locksmith. Places like Locks on Locks is just one I can think of off the top of my head that it has an online presence, and they have the computers they can bring out to your vehicle and do that programming and add a key if you have a master key. So, yep, that is. I would start with the locksmith. I think they're gonna find that to be most convenient and most economical.
Yeah. I they're pretty expensive. Really?
It is not a cheap thing. I mean, these can go to the tune of several hundred dollars, $400 or $500 sometimes. It's, you know, when you buy a new vehicle or a used vehicle, they often offer various kinds of insurance for tires and, you know, road hazard coverage and things, and incredibly one of those insurances they have anymore is for replacement keys and key fobs because they are so expensive.
Nancy, thank you very much for calling. Dean in Marquesan, your turn. Hi, Dean.
Good morning. Thank you for the show.
Sure.
I recently purchased a 2020 RAV4 hybrid. We love it. But I guess I finally come to a point where the car is smarter than I am.
Oh.
The cruise control. It's not just the speed. Of course, it's a lane minder. And I'm a little uncomfortable because it seems to want to stay pretty close to the center line on the highway. And I was wondering if you know of an adjustment to bring the car a little more to the right.
Well, there isn't an adjustment to make it go to the right. There is a sensitivity adjustment on how touchy it is. And as you know, they are touchy. I mean, if you've never driven a vehicle that's got lane departure, it can be unnerving. I mean, you just get close to that line and an alert goes off and it's good. It's like a little angel on your shoulder. I mean, the car becomes easier to steer back into the center of the lane and harder to steer out of the lane. And it's smart enough to know if you've used your turn signal. Of course, Dean has been driving and he knows all this. But there are two or three little adjustments that can affect the sensitivity of it. And, you know, there are times when, as you probably know, you can shut it off. Although it's good to have it on, it is almost dangerous to have. What we're discovering is like in high traffic situations, if you're on the Beltline in three or four lanes of traffic, you know, if you can imagine somebody pulling out in front of you suddenly or starting to cut you off, you're trying to make a correction without using a turn signal suddenly because it's an emergency and this car is trying to say, oh, no, don't go there. You know, it's trying to keep you from doing it. So they're great systems, and the majority of situations are going to help you out and prevent, a driver operational malfunction. But in emergency situations and heavy traffic areas, sometimes it can be a detriment. But, yeah, Dean, that is something that I recommend. You know, some adjustments you can do on your own. It's a, kind of like a hokey pokey you do with your multi-information screen. Some of them have to be done to dealer, and I'm not sure right off the top of my head if that's one you can do on your own, but it will be detailed in the owner manual. If you look up that lane departure system, it'll tell you what adjustments are available and if you can do them yourself.
Yeah, there you go, Dean. Thanks for calling. Dawn in La Crosse. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. About a year ago, I bought a 2017 Hyundai Elantra, which I love. And I haven't had any problems until the other day the check engine light came on. So I called to make an appointment to have it checked out. And, of course, they can't get you in for a week. And now after a couple of days, it went off again. And I know quite often it's like a gas cap. I hadn't just gotten gas or anything. So I was wondering if you had any ideas.
Well, it's certainly true that the gas cap, that gas tank vent system we call an evaporative emission system, is the most common thing to turn a check engine light on. There are probably 1,200 some codes on some cars that it can generate, but they mentioned that one and that one problem only in the owner's manuals of most of those cars because that, there's no code that says the gas cap is loose. The code says there's a leak in the system, and then the test that you do is not at the gas cap. You're hooking up a machine that makes like the disco floor smoke, essentially, that fills it up, and you watch for the leak and test to see that the system cycles on and off to its various parts of the system. So the fact that you didn't just get gas does not necessarily mean that isn't it. When it's cooler weather out, fuel doesn't produce. We don't see those codes much in the wintertime because it's too cool for the fuel to vaporize and make those kind of pressures much. But as weather gets hotter, it's more and more common. So, you know, if we had a few cool days since you got gas or the car's in underground parking or something, and then suddenly it's a real hot day and you go out, it certainly could trip it even though you hadn't just got gas. The fact, though, that the light's gone off means that the computer that turned it on, these computers use what we call multi-trip logic. Lots of fluky things happen in cars. The computers, for most codes, don't turn the light on the first time it sees it. It keeps it in its memory, and it says, if I see this again in a couple of drive cycles, within the next couple of drive cycles, I'm turning the light on. And then it does if it sees it. In the same way, if you start the car and run it, and the computer says, boy, I'm not seeing that problem anymore, it doesn't turn the light off the first time, but after a couple of drive cycles of not seeing that problem anymore, it shuts it off. The code that set the light, it will still be stored. So you could go to like an AutoZone and they'll read that code for free and they'll say, they'll have a percentage tell you, you know, certain 50% of people had this problem. It was fixed by buying and putting this on. And, you know, you don't necessarily have to do the repair because your car's not malfunctioning right now, but you could probably quickly and easily and for no cost get what code it was and what system it was. If it was that evaporative emission system, then you know, number one, at least, this is not a breakdown issue. This is an emission control system, which is an important one for our environment, but you know it would be something where, by golly, if you have to go on a trip next week, and you see a light, you're not terrified that the car is going to break down and this is something dangerous. And if it does turn out that the code was something more serious, it's not going to be diagnosable right now because the light's not on. But the key here would be if you see that light come on again, to try to get some diagnosis as quickly as you can after that because there's something intermittent going on here.
There you go, Don. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, talking vehicle maintenance today with Jim, service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your vehicle today and vehicle maintenance for summer travel with our guest, Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. Great to have him back. He's by every couple of months to talk with us, and nice to have him back again today. So, questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Tom in Wanakee emailed to ask what the proper cold tire pressure is. The one on the driver's door panel or the pressure indicated on the side of the tire. Also, recently heard someone say that gasoline contains ethanol, deteriorates in 8 weeks. Is that true or false? So two questions there from Tom.
Okay, well, first of all, the tire pressure question, that is a great question. You want to use the number that's on the placard on the door, not the one on the tire. The tire manufacturer doesn't know what application that tire is being put on, what kind of vehicle. So that's the maximum pressure. In most cases, it's going to be way too high for your car. So the placard is definitely what you want to go with there. fuel, primarily fuel that we have, Wisconsin does have ethanol in it. You can buy fuel without ethanol, and it has stabilizers in it. So I have not seen that issue. I've not seen a breakdown of ethanol and fuel in something like 8 weeks. The one thing when I hear ethanol and breakdown, what I do think of is non-automotive applications for fuel. So when you have two cycle devices like chainsaws and blowers and weed whackers and that kind of thing, those are applications where you do not want to use the ethanol, because it will, from the moment you put it in, not in 8 weeks, it'll start to break down the seals in those devices. So there is something important about using non-ethanol fuel in those types of equipment. But no, in your car, there are stabilizers in there. That's not an issue that we've seen.
Larry in Wanakee, up next with a question. Hi, Larry.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a F-150, 2004 F-150, bought it brand new, low mileage on it. I'm just hitting around 100,000 right now. I'm thinking about a tune-up. I know probably 5-6 years ago, I received a message, I believe from Ford. Well, that year has a terrible time with breaking spark plugs when they take them out. And I know they sent me a bulletin stating if you had it done in a garage, they would pay so much per plug. If you went to the Ford dealer would just take care of it. I don't know what I did with that bulletin. It might be in my old computer and it didn't transfer over. I went to a dealership here and I asked them about it. They said they don't know anything about it. And it's expensive to have these broken plugs taken out. I think it's maybe $300 a plug or so. My question is, I tried to go online and find that. I know I didn't dream that I got that. I don't know if that's a bulletin or if that's a warranty or if that's a recall or what that message was. But when I go online, the only thing I find is, somebody trying to sell me car insurance or, motor insurance.
Yeah, Larry, and you sure are hitting on a frustration for a lot of folks out there, and that it used to be that if the factory or if there was going to be something covered on a car, it was called a recall, and it was one simple thing. And now there are recalls, and there are customer support programs, and sometimes safety recalls tend to be federally mandated. A safety recall really is forever; it doesn't end. But there are so many other programs. Off the top of my head, I'm not specifically familiar with what program Ford might have had. So it might have been a temporary thing that they were just going to cover them for a period of time. And again, on my best days, the dealership I work at and every dealership is on top of every single factory program. And when you call, they know just what's going on and are on top of it. Unfortunately, they're all human beings. Sometimes that's not the case. So if it was a Ford factory program, what I would recommend is going to Ford.com. There's a place where you can put your VIN number from your vehicle, the 17-digit vehicle identification number in, and they'll tell you any programs that are or were on that vehicle, and you can get a better idea. That's where I would recommend starting with that question.
Makes good sense. Thanks, Larry. Appreciate it. Nancy in Grafton, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Well, I just want to say, after many years as automotive teacher here in Grafton, Carl Hader has retired, and some of his students won first place in the United States in the nation. And he was a wonderful teacher, and to teach young people, boys and girls, how to work with their hands and how to do productive things like Carl Hader did. I just want to say thank you to those people, and like Carl, who really, really put their effort into teaching our young people how to be mechanics. And God bless you all. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Nancy. Carl Hader, local auto mechanics teacher from the Grafton area.
A lot of people know how to work on cars, but not everybody can be a mentor. And truly, fewer and fewer people are going into automotive. And our recruiting efforts, honestly, started middle school levels and with high schools and everything. And so it's a great thing when someone does something like that. And, he's retired, great loss to that community. But, that is a fantastic to have somebody who's a great mentor like that.
Yeah, thank you so much, Nancy, for calling. Nice to give a shout out. Julie and Toma, your turn. Hi, Julie.
Good morning, almost afternoon. Thanks for taking my call and a great show. I have a 2013 Toyota Venza, and I got it in 2016, had 27,000 miles on it, and the upholstery and inside was in great condition. I think a sales guy had it. He didn't spill coffee or anything. But ever since, I've had difficulty keeping the inside upholstery clean. It's a fabric upholstery, and yes, it's a light color. But I had the same kind of light color and upholstery in a different Toyota years ago, and I never had issues. It stains so easily, and I know that they don't use chemicals on this. I've tried a product from recommended by an auto store. I know you don't want to endorse products, but what can I do? Is there anything homemade cleaner-wise? I'd really like to clean it myself. I'm kind of hands-on, so I'll hang up and I'll listen. Thanks a lot.
You bet. Well, the easiest solution and the safest solution is something as simple as you know, a water vinegar solution. But there were a few years there, and I do know what you're talking about. Certain fabrics, and we had a couple of those that just seemed to stain so easily, and the stains will come out. But you know, typically, a dry cleaning solution, you know, something that you can clean those off with is going to be best. And I typically, you know, use simple solutions like either water and baking soda or water and vinegar on those kind of things to start with. You'd mentioned that a shop had recommended a product, and I wasn't clear if that product was a cleaning product or something to put on the seat of sealants. But one of the easiest ways to remove the frequency that you have to clean it is that once you do get them clean, there are products to seal the fabric. You know, there are lots of different companies that make those, but that is what I'd recommend, is that you know, you could use, I don't know what they're stained with necessarily, so there are different products you'd use for different types of stains, but once you get them clean, the key here is going to be to get some fabric sealer that you can put on there that's going to slow down how often you have to clean them and how easily the fabric absorbs, you know, various materials that get on it to cause a stain.
Yeah, makes good sense. Pat in Wauwatosa, what's on your mind?
Well, I have a 2005 Prius, which I love. It has 87,000 miles. It's parked inside. Now, I had an oil change last November. My daughter took it in. They said, there are all sorts of things that should be done now. Well, so I've driven very little since then due to surgery and the pandemic. So I'm wondering, can I go through the summer? I'm worried about the tire pressure and things. They told me they changed things for winter and summer. I'm just wondering if you don't know, of course, about all these other things they want me to do, but I'm wondering whether fluids and tire pressure, if I could just wait till next November. I hardly drive very much at all anymore. Do you think I can just wait, or do you think I should take it in and, under the excuse of an oil change, I get the tires and fluid checked and everything?
Well, if it's, when was it last checked? When did you last have it in and have
it in? November.
November. And you haven't driven it very much. It's only about 6 months. So, you know, I guess you wouldn't necessarily even have to schedule oil change. You know, the shop would probably do that inspection for you. You know, something I would certainly do. Most shops would do that and take a look at things. You know, some of the things that they had put on that list, there might be other concerns now. Cars that sit a long time, we have more concerns. We're seeing a greater replacement of like 12-volt batteries from cars sitting a month and a half, 2 months, 3 months, than we would normally this time of year. You know, and I'm not sure what they meant by tire pressures. The tire pressures is something that, I mean, that isn't a repair. I don't know if they found your tire pressures low or if they were just mentioning to you that, which is true, that we do put a little bit more air in the winter than summer. But it would really, we need to take a look at that specific list. Most often, Pat, there, you can defer some of those things, you know, depending on what it is. If they're talking preventative maintenance, you know, and that's what you really want, what any of us want as a consumer. And if you're an automotive consumer, when it comes to service and maintenance and repairs on your car, is you want somebody that helps you prioritize that stuff. So one of the first things I might try is just contacting that dealership and the individual that gave you that list and just put it right out like that. I don't think I'm going to do all this right now. I'd like your opinion on what the most important order is and what, you know, and they can and will do that. Most often we get in such a hurry in our workday that we just give you a list and say this all needs to be done, but it isn't true that it all needs to be done. Usually it's not the case that it all needs to be done today or next week, and they can be prioritized. So without looking at the list, I can't give you the priorities, but that really is your best bet. And if you find that you can't get that from where you took the car, that's really what you want, is to find a place where you can build that kind of rapport. More and more repair shops and dealerships and facilities want to be in that consultative business where you give you all that information rather than just saying, this is a list, this is what you need, this is what it costs, I can help you schedule it, because you need a lot more information than that. It doesn't all have to be done now. So see if you can get that from them. If you can't, I would inquire around the area that you live, and you're going to find a shop that fits that relationship of building a good rapport with you and giving you that good consultative advice.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling and emailed. She had a mouse in her 2003 Chevy Trailblazer over the winter, a mouse nest. The dealership removed the nest, but there's a very bad smell. Comes through the vents when the fan's on. They don't want to get asphyxiated. What can they do in 20 seconds?
System refresh is what it's called. It doesn't go into where the refrigerant is. It's products that flush out where the airflow goes through, and that's probably where they built the nest. And that's the least and cheapest and least invasive thing you could try first. Hopefully, they have not to take the whole thing apart and scrub or replace components inside.
All right. Thank you very much for that question. And tell you what, thank you for listening. I hope you stay with us. Jim Ward will be with us right till 12:30. We'll take a look now at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with Jim. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Taking a look at your vehicle today is Jim Ward. Back with us once again, service manager at Smart Motors Toyota of Madison. And always fun to have him with us. And he's here to answer your vehicle maintenance questions. So give a call with your questions at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's go right back to the phones and to Dave in Saukville next. Hi, Dave. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, I own a Honda Accord and a Honda Pilot, and they both take 0W20 oil. And my local service guy says that I really shouldn't pay attention to the service indicator on my dash, and I should bring it in much more frequently for oil changes, because the 0W oil doesn't really protect that well. I was wondering what your opinion is on that.
Well, I'll tell you, my opinion was, for the longest time, initially didn't see a lot of problems, that for the good of the environment, that the 10,000-mile interval was a good interval, but people are not in the habit of checking their oil, and as vehicles get older and can develop oil consumption issues, it becomes a concern. So if you are really good at checking your oil and you are confident that if you'd catch it, somewhere between 5,000 and 7,000 miles, if it was down a quarter or two or using oil and you'd add it and you feel comfortable with that, then the 10,000-mile interval is probably okay for you. If that's not something that you're going to do, not in your wheelhouse, then, I haven't recommended as much, but I'm seeing more and more people switch it to a 5,000-mile interval. It's more peace of mind. It's a bit more money, and it's a bit more use of oil and things that we'd like to see, on the more 10,000 intervals, a great economic one. But I have seen some problems with that. I've seen older cars start to use some oil and people not keep up with it and cause problems. So, I have to admit at this point that I think that for a lot of people that the 5,000-mile interval is a safer, for their vehicle, for the investment they have in keeping it in good running condition and probably greater peace of mind and not worrying whether, what is going to happen between 5,000 and 10,000 miles at the oil level.
Yeah, there you go, Dave. Thank you. Brad in Saukville, on to you now. Hi, Brad.
Hey, how you guys doing today?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Great, Brad.
Calling because I've got a 2006 Ford Explorer, and I'd say between first, second, and third gear, anywhere between 0 to 45 miles an hour, the best way I can describe the feeling in the gas pedal would be like rubbing two cinder blocks or two bricks together, so you get that real grit feeling to it. I'm not sure if that's a fluid issue or if that's a legitimate, I got to get my tranny looked at.
This is consistent, whether the engine's cold, like you just started the first time of the day, or whether it's warmed up, you get this gritty feeling at the shift points.
Yeah, and it's not all the time. It's intermittent. Like, sometimes it'll go 0 to 45, no problems, but then other times it'll feel really, really gritty.
Well, you know, that's an electronically controlled transmission. It has the ability to set codes for a lot of malfunctions that occur, but it can't set a code typically for dirty fluid that's just starting to affect shifts. And those transmissions are also pretty sensitive to fluid levels. So if the fluid level is off a little bit, you'd think if the fluid level is off that it would be a more consistent problem, but not necessarily true. Automatic, you know, different than an engine oil. An engine oil dipstick has got one full and one low reading. But if you ever look at an automatic transmission fluid dipstick, and fewer vehicles have them because more and more are sealed transmissions, but they have two sets of marks, one for hot and one for cold. So, you know, the fluid and the fluid controlled components in the transmission can behave differently depending on the load and temperature and circumstances. But certainly the place to start is to have the condition of the fluid and the fluid level checked. They can certainly cause some of those things. And we want to hope that's it, because that's some of the cheapest stuff that you might be doing to an automatic transmission.
Absolutely. Thanks, Brad. Appreciate it. Tab in Mazamani, your turn. Hi, Tab.
Good morning. I have a question for Jim. We bought a 2018 Highlander from Smart Motors. Car run is fine. Except a month and a half ago, we got a recall notice from Toyota about the fuel pump. So does Jim have any information on when these fuel pumps would be replaced? And number two question is, if we are going to visit our daughter in Milwaukee and the fuel pump lets go and doesn't function, is Toyota responsible for the cost to, you know, get the car back towed to Toyota? And I'll listen to you on the phone. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Sure. Sure. So that's a recall situation where, and often this will be what people experience on any kind of vehicle. You get a recall notice telling you that they're starting a recall. There's this issue with the car. This is what can happen, but we don't have a remedy for it yet. Either the parts aren't made or they're still working on the research and development of exactly what's going to fix it. And that's the case here. This vehicle has a couple of fuel pumps, a low pressure pump that pushes it up to the engine, and then the pressure pump that creates the pressure we need for the engine to run. That low pressure pump can fail. I've not seen breakdown issues with it, but I have seen difficulty in starting. I have seen people lose, you know, reporting losing power on the highway, almost, you know, like the cruise control kicked out, and then, you know, kind of was temporary. So, you know, it is a concern in this interim period. The time frame I am understanding right now is they expect to have a remedy out by September. There are various programs. If you were to have a breakdown, the vehicle, all different manufacturers have different types of road assistance programs, roadside assistance. Toyota's is 2 years. So on an 18, there's a good chance that vehicle is still under that two-year road hazard program, and that would cover towing for any given kind of problem on the vehicle, including that fuel pump. You know, if you have a lot of traveling to do, this is also a situation where, you know, if you simply don't feel safe on it, Toyota does have a provision, and most manufacturers will in these situations, to provide you a loaner car until the remedy's out. And you know, because your vehicle's parked at the dealership until the remedy comes out. So, you know, for some folks that you know, have real concerns about it, that is an option as well. Again, for the most part, I haven't seen this as a breakdown issue, but, you know, when it's out there and there's no remedy, I certainly understand the concern.
Yeah, absolutely. Ted in Madison emailed, he has a 2009 Toyota Prius that makes some high-pitched noises when he turns the steering wheel, with the noise generally increasing the further he turns the wheel. His mechanic has told him that it's some kind of sealed unit, so parts can't be replaced or maintained. Is any way to do any maintenance or to lubricate this power steering hardware?
Well, without knowing what's making the noise, you know, there was a time when we decided, oh, you got a steering noise, that's the belt is loose for the power steering pump, but this vehicle uses electronic power steering. It doesn't have that pump, and, you know, I would have to, you know, I'd like to listen to it and see what this noise is. I mean, it's a squeak can be caused by the steering shafts between the steering wheel and the pump, you know, but without hearing the noise, I'm not sure what we've got. But it is true, there's not much in the way of adjustment, maintenance, or repairs of that system. But, you know, without knowing what the, you know, without hearing it and knowing it, this isn't like a common problem on 09 Priuses where I hear that sometimes and think, this is what's going on here. I don't have an answer off the top of my head, but the answer is probably not going to be, you know, that there's some maintenance. But it's certainly something. I'd want to hear it. If the technician who looked at it is recommending the power steering pump, yeah, there isn't rebuild kits for that pump. If he's saying that the electronic power steering, is failing, that's not going to be something that you can do anything with except replace.
All right, Tom in Buffalo County up next. Hi, Tom.
Yes, hello, gentlemen. Yeah, I've got an old Volkswagen 99 1.8-liter turbo. Anyway, I was getting poor gas mileage this whole winter, and I couldn't figure it out. So finally this spring, I got myself an OBDI reader. And suddenly I read it out, and it's like, well, my engine temperature is only 165 degrees. I go, what the heck?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, okay. Yeah, I replaced the thermostat then, bought a new one, and said, okay, let's get a genuine VW part, et cetera. And I said, geez, after I change it, I'm checking for leaks. And it's like I looked down for water leaks, and I said, my God, there's an oil leak there. Looks like it's coming from the main crankshaft seal. And, okay, so I buy the parts to change that. And then about, let's say this month now, it's like suddenly that oil leak stopped. Could that have been caused by the fact that the engine was running at low temperatures for the whole winter? Would that have caused an oil leak?
Hmm.
That is an interesting question. Often oil leaks, particularly at a main seal, the seal can just fail. But over the years, I've often seen that caused by the what's called a PCV system, positive crankcase ventilation system, being plugged. And that plug often occurs at a valve that is supposed to keep, it's supposed to prevent any kind of a backfire from coming back up to the intake. And so it handles a lot of varnish and soot and can get sticky where the valve will stick. Creates more pressure in the engine, causes a leak, and I don't know about it running cold causing that leak to occur, because your engine is cold when you start it on a very, very cold days, and oil doesn't leak out just because it's cold. So the cold certainly would cause the poor gas mileage, because the engine has to run a richer fuel mixture while it's warming up, and in your case, it was never warming up, so it was just using that rich fuel mixture all the time. And that it's possible that on earlier air-cooled Volkswagens, and this is not, we would often see fuel dilution. And when an engine runs cold, you may be getting more raw fuel getting dumped into the oil, which may make the oil thin, which may make it more likely to leak. So, if you've had an oil change since winter, one of the possibilities, I guess, the two things that I think are most likely are either that the PCV system was plugged up, but that doesn't usually heal itself, or that it had a lot of gas in the oil, and you've had an oil change since then, and that has changed the, how much fuel's in the oil in the crankcase, and that changes its viscosity and whether it's likely to leak or not. So a couple of possibilities that come to mind. I don't think that the thermostat and it running cold caused oil leak, though.
All right. There you go, Tom. Thank you. Carol in Madison, your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call.
You're welcome. I have a question about the GPS system. We have a brand new Honda CR-V, and when you're trying to use the GPS system, you cannot understand the voice coming, the directions. They're too faint. They're not loud enough, especially if the radio's on. It doesn't balance at all. And I wondered, I've looked all through the book, I can't find any way to adjust it. Is that something that should be adjustable?
I believe it is. And sometimes increasingly they're giving consumers the ability to adjust some of those customizable parameters. But often the dealership still has to hook up a computer to do them. And I'll tell you that symptom you're describing is something increasingly over the years I've seen addressed by software updates. So I'd make an inquiry at Honda and just find out if it's a condition they're familiar with. And I'm going to bet there's either adjustment to balance the volume, but if it's not just volume and it seems kind of garbled, there may be software updates available too for those systems that help make it much clearer.
All right, there you go, Carol. Rick in Grafton, hello.
Hey, good morning. I've got a 98 Civic that has 352,000 miles, and I have this thing checked out every time I have an oil change. And at what point in time do you say I'm not going to drive it because the miles are high, or do you just plow forward and keep your fingers crossed? I love the car. Everything works. What do you think?
Well, just by your enthusiasm, I think you're going to drive it and keep your fingers crossed is what I think you're going to do. But I'll tell you, I mean, that's an interesting question. I had a customer for years here who had, it was on a mission, the same kind of mission that you're on, at about a 92 Camry that kept it in showroom condition, and I'm going to drive this thing until, and I mean, somebody could easily afford to buy a new car and drive it anything they want. And a few times over the years, we had conversation about, does this make any sense? Let's look what all I put in it over the years. And when it got to where what he'd put in it in maintenance and repairs was twice what he'd originally paid for it, we were scratching our heads. But when we figured out the car payment formula as to what he would have paid, he was thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars ahead. Last summer, I think it was about 450,000 miles, finally the engine blew up and he bought a new vehicle. But, you know, so it's not going to last forever, but if you're, you know, you've taken good care of it, I don't, you know, people get a 500,000 miles on those things. I mean, it is possible. And again, you sound like you love it and you're very enthusiastic about it. I'm picturing you crossing your fingers and keeping this thing going.
Me too. Thanks, Rick. Appreciate it. Well, Ron in La Crosse, we'll go to you next. Hi, Ron.
Yes, I got a question. I have a 1992 Lincoln I inherited from my father, and I did have the tires changed in, I think, the fall of 2007. And the car, so far, I don't remember what the mileage was then, but right now there's only less than 41,000 miles on it. And a mechanic over at a local shop where I have it serviced said, you know, about my truck, I had tires replaced on my Ford Ranger, but I haven't had them replaced on the Lincoln since November of 2007 because of the low mileage on it. Should I worry about the condition of the rubber if it starts to crack or something? I should just go ahead and replace them even if the treads are still deep enough?
Tire manufacturers would tell you to replace them. They generally are going to tell you 6 to 7 years tires are going to have broken down, both from ozone in the atmosphere and from sun damage. Now, of course, if the vehicle is stored inside, then there's less likelihood of sun damage and a little bit less exposure to environmental ozone and other, you know, factors that break them down. But these are 13-year-old tires. You know, I've seen people go by whether it's got cracks in it or not, but you know, tires seem fairly expensive, but really when you think about the consequences of a tire blowing out and taking the chance, it's probably not worth it. 13-year-old tires, you know, if you're only ever going to drive it around town in parade conditions, even then, if a tire blows out, it's an unexpected thing. So I'm going to have to stick with the tire manufacturers on this one and say, yep, at the age of those tires, you really do want to think about replacing them.
There you go, Ron. Thank you for calling. Sharon in Appleton emailed that she has a 2001 Toyota Avalon XL. She had the alternator replaced in September of 2019. Now the battery will not hold a charge, and she has to get a jump start. After the jump start, she can drive across town, but then it won't restart, and she has to get another jump to get home. She had the battery tested, and they said the battery's good. The battery's dated January of 2017. Could the alternator be bad already, or is it something else?
Well, I'll tell you, there are when it comes to alternators, there, as cars get older, you know, but I work at a new car dealer, so there's lots of types of repair shops out there. There's independent shops and new car dealers. New car dealers are typically going to be working with the factory part, and independent shops will often work with factory parts and sometimes with aftermarket parts. As vehicles get older and higher mileage, and you know, it makes sense to try to be a little more economical with repairs, almost all of us are going to start looking at aftermarket parts. New car dealerships, too, will recommend that. But there are some instances where that aftermarket part, we just don't see the life out of it. And two areas on Toyota's on that Avalon would be the alternator and the starter. If I put an aftermarket one on there, they just, for whatever reason, those off-brand, they don't seem to hold up as well. So, you know, I would be surprised if it was a Toyota alternator that was put on it. If it failed again this soon, I wouldn't be that surprised if it was an aftermarket one, because, you know, we've tried to help people economize and put aftermarket parts on with the warning, but I've seen 6 to 12-month failures on aftermarket alternators lots of times. So, I mean, that is possible. There's a fairly quick and easy test that can be done to tell whether the alternator is charging, whether that's the problem or not. But, you know, so some testing should be done to determine. Batteries can give you a false positive and say they're good when they're not. So, you know, that should probably be tested again, along with testing the charging output of the alternator. And if those things all test good, then we start looking into whether there's something in that electrical system that's staying on when it shouldn't and drawing it down.
Hmm. Mark in Rhinelander emailed, he has a 2013 Jeep Wrangler. It accumulates a lot of water under the carpet on the driver's side front only. He tried to troubleshoot with a garden hose and couldn't find the culprit. He removed the kick panel and all the trim to expose the bare body when he did some troubleshooting. It also gets wet with both the hard top and the soft top. Any ideas?
Well, the hard top, soft top eliminates my wondering whether it had a sunroof. It doesn't have a sunroof. Yeah, my idea is when we first started talking about road trips and unlikely things, one of the things I mentioned was the air conditioner. And the air conditioner, it evaporates moisture out of the air, and that moisture collects on a device called the evaporator and drips into a little dishpan-sized pan with a hose that runs out under the vehicle. And my guess is that that is plugged up, and that water is not running out that hose, and it collects and it dumps into the driver's floor pan. And so, you know, I would run that vehicle with the air conditioner on. And you know, one thing to keep in mind is that air conditioning is not just on a hot day when you turn the air conditioning on. Air conditioning is on in most modern vehicles anytime you have it on defrost in the winter as well. You may not see moisture condensation running out in the winter because there isn't that much of it in the air at that point, but in the summer you certainly would. So you run that air conditioner on a good hot humid day and watch underneath the vehicle. You used to see water running out. The hose usually is along the firewall, a little bit more to the passenger side, and ultimately you want to be a little careful. The first inclination might just be to stick something up in that hose, but there's a device up in there, much like a radiator in the front of the car, which has got fins, which are really fine, and you could damage it. So you're better off to kind of take the carpet apart underneath the passenger side and see if you can find where that hose comes off the plastic evaporator box, and then just try to deal with just clearing the hose. You could have a plug in that box too, but this is likely where your problem is. Yeah, it's probably not an exterior water leak coming in.
And finally, Joe in Washburn wonders why we don't have our cars made with stainless steel in body construction so they don't rust out.
Well, they do make cars with stainless steel. The DeLorean Motor Company was a car that was made with stainless steel, and in fact, they are back in business in a real small-scale way. There's one simple word for it. It's expensive. It's expensive, and it's high maintenance. I remember I worked at a DeLorean dealer in the early 80s, and it was you know, as you look at stainless steel appliances like in kitchens, they've come up with finishes and things so that, you know, every single fingerprint doesn't leave this mark standing out. But the DeLoreans back in those days were more like the early stainless steel in kitchens, where it was a real pain to keep it up. It's beautiful. Stainless steel is beautiful, but it isn't practical and it's expensive, and that's why you're not seeing lots of cars. But they're out there. They do make stainless steel cars.
Well, Jim, it's always a pleasure. You're going to be back August 20th, if my figures are right here. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I look forward to your next visit. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Larry.
Jim Ward, Service Manager at Smart Motors Toyota of Madison. It was always great to have him with us, and he'll be back August 20th. Looking ahead tomorrow on Garden Talk, Brian Huddleston will be back to help you with your plant disease questions. That's tomorrow at 11, Saturday morning at 6, or online anytime. And don't forget to check out our blog. We have some new posts about spiders and biking. Just go to WPR.org/Larry to see what's there. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.